for the working people in this state, and a higher quality of life for those well-connected entrepreneurs, or so-called entrepreneurs. It's a shifting of the money from the working people over into the hands of a few people trying to make a profit out of state dollars. Serious consideration. If you want to see a lower standard of life in this state, then put it out there to where people are making $8 an hour. Now, when you say that, and I look at it, our standard of living in this state has gone down over the last 8 or 10 years. We are no longer, our citizens, our wages are no longer the best in the nation. They used to be. Corresponding to the increased amount of people that are making less, we have more we put in jail. We got more we put in jail. Because as they can't afford to put food on the table to do things, they look at breaking the law. Their standard of living is down. They want to live like anybody else should, or everybody should. We put more in prison. I got some ideas for cost savings. I know you've asked others that. Let's have the legislature going to meet only once every 2 years. You guys meeting every year, you make more laws. You make more criminals. We don't need all those laws. I mean, I look at it here locally. We just, in the city of Anchorage, we are now going to make more lawbreakers out of our kids because we put a curfew in place. That's going to cost more. The results of you going to Juneau and making laws and putting more laws in book to put more people in prisons is only going to increase the prison budget. And I give you this. I think that what you ought to do is look at ways that you can increase the standard of living for all working people in the state. You want to save money in corrections. Increase the standard of living, increase the wages, benefits for employees that are out there working. Don't lower them, and you'll have less people in jail. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Don. And before we open up to questions, I feel like I am forced to respond to what your testimony was. Within your testimony, you made the implication with a direct statement that private prisons are, in fact, more dangerous and have a worse safety record than public facilities. And the record simply does not bear that out. I stated that in my opening statement. We took the time to check it out, to call the national and international organizations which monitor these activities, and that statement, that position simply is not true. The second notion that you made, Don, that privatization within prisons, within the state, is bad. We live in a capitalist society. I'm sorry, but I happen to believe that it's all right to make a buck in this society. The third thing, that there's no vocational training within these facilities, is also incorrect. I personally visited a facility down in Texas that former Governor Ann Richards opened, related to drug abuse and alcohol abuse down there. They have a stellar record of vocational training. The kid comes in there and they don't have a degree, a high school degree, they don't have a choice about what programs they're going into. They're going to be in class 40 hours a week plus. They have a stellar record of turning their people around and working with them and trying to break the cycle of dependency of coming back into the system. Beyond that, your implication that Bay of Building Maintenance falls apart is also incorrect. Down there, that contractor is required at the end of that contract to turn the building back over to the state or whatever facility, whatever entity which owns that facility in the same condition which it was built. They are required as part of their contract to provide building maintenance. And your last point in relation to saving costs, don't incarcerate as many people. Well, that'd be easy if we didn't have people out there breaking the law. But the fact is, all of us at one point in time have been victims to crime. We've witnessed it. We've experienced it ourselves personally. People around us are concerned. They're upset. People in our society weren't concerned, we wouldn't pass laws. about crime. But the reality is there are people out there are concerned about it. The reality is we are going to get tough with crime. We are going to put more people away. I mean, you've seen the statistics yourself. More violent crimes are being done by kids with guns. What does that relate to in practical terms from our standpoint? That means we're going to be putting more people away for a longer period of time. 14, 15, 16 year olds blowing each other away. I mean, that's a reality. That's not something out there. That's happening today, and it's happening more frequently. And when a 16 year old commits a murder and we put him away for 99 years, he's away a long time. It's not like throwing a 50 year old or a 60 year old away. This kid's going to be in the system a long time. So we're going to have continued pressure on our prison system. It's not realistic to say that we shouldn't be putting people away. We're going to do it. The public demands that we do it. Now we're just left with the challenge of trying to figure out how we can afford it. Now I agree with you and the commissioner to the extent that we have to force communities to accept some financial responsibility for their demand or desire for increased incarceration, for getting tough on crime. It's easy to be tough on crime when you don't have to pay the tab. But if you've got to participate in picking up the tab, you're going to spend a little more time focusing on prevention, you know, keeping these prisons, people out of prisons before they start, than you are on just, hey, let's throw them away, and lock them away and throw away the key. So I agree with you to that extent. But it's not realistic to say that we're not going to be tough on crime, because that's not what I stand for, and I don't think that's what the public out there wants. With that, I'll open up for questions for Don.
I don't really have any questions. I'll just say I think his point is valid, that when you have a very low standard of living and people don't have hope and don't see how life can be better for them, it does tend to lead them into these other paths that are bad for society as a whole. So I think what we need to do in the big picture is figure out how we can put more emphasis on prevention. It's obvious this track we're on is very, very expensive. I think that we're making some fundamental errors in just the way we're approaching things overall. I mean, I realize our subcommittee is focused on the back end after things have gone wrong, but we should think long term about how to keep people out of prison. And I think the standard of living and the quality of life does have a great deal to do with why people end up in prison.
And I share with you, and it was easy when there was lots of money in the state. Everybody was on the gravy train. And this is something that the lower 48 states have been experiencing for years, and it's just recently coming to Alaska. When there are shortage of resources, shortage of dollars, things get pinched. And that's also part of the prey or part of the victim of a capitalist society. Some people are going to get rich, some people are going to have more, and some people are going to have less, as opposed to socialist society where everybody has nothing. So,
or a socialist society where everyone gets a dividend check.
Exactly.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Davis.
I made specific note of the Mr. Valesco statement about the wages and making paupers, making some rich and some poor. I think, you know, that's something real valid. I think we don't want a lot of additional low-paying jobs, substandard wages in the state. We all know that any married couple can't, with one working at $8 an hour, just can't make it. But what I see driving the whole thing, though, is what is the alternative? Additional government. Expand government. And that is one of the key issues facing not only Alaska, and we're facing it now probably a few years later than the outside. Privatization started outside, and now it's coming this way because of that issue. Do we look at the, I think there's a major public concern for the amount of government employees in the state, counting federal, state, and local governments. That's a concern, and I think from a public standpoint, that's the issue that we're looking at. We can listen to we can listen to this side of the story, we can listen to the other side of the story, then we got, as legislators, got to go back to the public and find out, now what do you guys want? We know what you want, we know what they want, what does the public want?
And I think incumbent upon us also, Representative Davis, you bring a good point, and that relates exactly to what Don said, that whatever we do, there have to be safeguards built into the system to the fact that we ensure ensure public safety, that when you, whatever you do, whether it be public or private, the most important part is having adequately trained guards and officers, people within the system, to ensure public safety. That's the largest overriding concern, whether it be public or a private entity, and that would be something that I'd make certain that, you know, whatever we do is a big consideration. Don?
I had it written in my off-the-cuff notes that I didn't state, and I think I will state it here. When I said raising the wages of workers out there, raising the standard of living, we need to, and I firmly believe this, try and move our society back to a 1-8 wage earner family. One wage earner in the family, and I don't care if it's the male or the female or the significant other or which one it is, it doesn't matter to me, because without parental supervision, we are seeing the problem manifest in our schools, in our prisons, in our society. And it is a result of this nation and this state of people trying to drive the wages and the workers down in order that a few can make the big bucks. And that is wrong. I believe in the capitalist system. I believe in it firmly. But not to the point where there's a class society with such differentiation that we have gone to in the last few years. And it just makes my job tougher out there trying to get the decent wages and benefits. If you look at state employment and you're looking at the employees of the state, they have only had 3 cost of living increases since 1987 for state employees in the state. Means I've been falling down on my job, and some of these employees behind me are throwing darts at me right now. But you know, we're not keeping up with the cost of living, and consequently, we're seeing our prison industry rise. Not just public employees are going there too; they're kids. So
I recognize what you're saying, Don, and I appreciate what you're saying. But you also take that against the long-range financial plan, and they recommended that the state, the average state salary was 8% above its counterpart in the private sector, and they recommended that we bring state salaries back in line. And at the same time, they're talking about an income tax. They have a lot of bitter pills, not only for us, but also for your entities.
We're probably going to get there in the next 3 years with the contracts that have been negotiated if the legislature approves them, because you're talking about consumer cost of living increases only equal to half of the CPI. What you got to do is get everybody else up there raising their standard of living. In other words, I've always lived by it. Don't go over there and try and drag somebody else down to make you look better. Build yourself up to that person's level. And don't try and drag people down. Let's build everybody up. That's what I say.
Representative James?
I guess I just have to make a comment. I certainly would agree with the gentleman that $8 to $10 an hour is not acceptable. When we have people who are on welfare getting benefits equal to $15.48 an hour, I don't think we should have anybody in this state working for less than $15 an hour. Problem is, how do we do that? They have to make money. And now we get back to basic industry. If we don't make any money in this state, there's nobody to pay those kind of wages. And we can't just shuffle money around and from one person to another and have it be the same dollar when it gets by there. So we have to make some money in the state. But when you look at the Department of Labor, the rates of pay for the various different kinds of occupations, resource development pays the most. mining, timber, any kind of construction, those kinds of things where you create something, you make money, they pay the highest wages. But we're living in a service industry in this state, not only a service industry, but government. And just moving that money around just won't create enough to pay those kinds of things. So I think what we really have to do is we have to seriously look at how we can increase our economy by making money. That's the problem in the United States. For all of these years, we've spent nearly $5 trillion more than we've made. The problem isn't that we're spending too much money, it's that we're not making enough. And we have to be able to zero in so that we can get people to create things that actually create wealth in our country. It is a problem. It's not going to be solved at this table. It's not going to be solved when you take one segment of the problems. It's a problem that has to be solved in the overall picture. And then we'll be able to maybe have one family income. That certainly is an applaudable goal. And certainly I believe that when people's financial difficulties are so severe, that's when we have suicides, crime on the streets, drug and alcohol addiction, domestic violence, you name it. All of those things are directly related to not being able to support themselves, and that's where we're going to have to put our concentration.
As I testified before the Long Range Planning Commission, one of the areas that seriously concerns me, we talk about economic development. We also have needs for services from the government, things that are constitutionally required, such as education, such as road repair, maintaining of the roads, supplying a transportation system, such as the public safety portion of it. Without a structure to take in money from those people that come in, and Fort Knox mine up in your area is a good example. You may add 500 jobs there, 500 new people, but that is going to cost the state more money because we take no income from that other than the little bit of mining tax that doesn't pay for the education of all of those kids, of the people that are going to go to work there. It does not pay for rebuilding the Steese Highway that they're tearing apart as they move their product and do the construction out there. It does not pay for the additional law enforcement. We've got to have a tax structure in this state. And I know that politically, all the politicians, you want to stay in office, you don't say the T word. But you got to be thinking about it because that is how government works. That's how it works.
And on that, I agree with you. We have to have some revenue coming into our state that's directly related to the economic activity in our state, either a sales tax or an income tax. We have to have that. Problem is, we're spending so much on government right now, we can't afford to maintain this level of government. And until we reduce our government spending, people are not willing to pay a tax. That's the realism of it.
Well, where it's directed. I look at Local 71. We maintain the state's roads. There are less equipment operators today than there were in 1976. So if you want to talk, where's the increased cost going? Yeah, we've gotten the wages up. We've managed to hold on to the benefits as best we could. But there's no more of them. There's less operators today maintaining the state's road than there were in 76 before $1 throw through the pipeline. And we've got bigger and better roads. So some parts of government may be growing. I can tell you it's not the direct services that a lot of people want, that I represent. Any more?
Thank you.
I didn't mean to get it into a debate.
No problem. Next up is Gary Webster, the superintendent of 6th Avenue. Is Gary here? I know we're ahead of schedule. And what's that?
He's coming.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you for joining us today, Gary. I know the mayor takes a keen interest in your facility, as he's reported to me.
Yes. Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. Appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak with you today. I started out at the Ridgeview Correctional Center. Right before it closed, I went to 3rd Avenue. Right when it closed, I went to 6th Avenue under the threat that it was closing. They won't let me work anywhere else. But what I'd like to do is reiterate something that Dennis Geary had mentioned, in just a couple of areas, one being Sixth Avenue. In the comparison, whenever you do any comparisons between facilities or different types of services, I would appreciate it if the whole thing was taken into consideration. Sixth Avenue provides a wide number of services, a lot of them that are just basically hidden from view. We dovetail with a lot of different agencies, law enforcement agencies, the federal, state, and city. We do with the court systems, military police, attorneys. We do a lot with the halfway houses. Sixth Avenue is a pretrial facility that books in all the misdemeanors in the Anchorage area, as well as the female felons. We process all the sentenced prisoners that the court remands into custody to serve their time. They come in at 8 o'clock in the morning. We process them out. We designate where all those prisoners are going to serve their time. So we provide that like classification type service as well. We send hundreds of prisoners to the halfway houses each month. When these prisoners are caught with drugs or fighting or violating some of the Senate rules, we're responsible to bring them back into a secured facility and begin the disciplinary process on those folks. Whenever there's a escape or walkway from halfway houses, Sixth Avenue has to begin the paperwork for those people to try to get them back into custody. Without all those, with all that backup for the CRCs, that type of service augments and helps the CRCs to remain effective programs. As a result of the screening for those who are not eligible to go to the halfway houses and getting back those ones that don't make it there, we end up with a wide variety of prisoners. Most of them are pretrial. Still, about 80 or 90% are pretrial. Because whenever they're sentenced, we try to get them out as soon as we can. But we end up with people with serious medical needs, a lot of psychological problems, and just people with bad behavior. They don't make it anywhere else. That type of prisoner requires more security and other types of care, which drives the cost up. Because we're an intake, we also provide 24-hour medical coverage. The fact that people are coming in there at all hours of the day or night. Cook Inlet Pretrial shares the responsibility for providing medical coverage for the halfway houses, so we split that as well. It was suggested that contracting out Sixth Avenue might be a possibility. On the surface, things look kind of easy that maybe we just deal with misdemeanors, but we do a lot more than that. A contract facility is never overcrowded due to the fact that when the state draws up a contract, they require a certain amount of beds and they never push in over that amount. Public facility is more flexible because they don't have that limitation based on how many prisoners they can hold or type of services they can provide. If something comes up, we do it. No one can predict when or why where the crimes occur. occur or when the criminals are going to be caught and brought in. The count there at 6th Avenue changes by the hour. It's always moving in and out. Still, we're able to accomplish all those things at under $90 a day. That's not including all the client billing that we do. That's just straight bare cost, figuring out 120 minutes a day. If you consider all the different roles and factors that make up 6th Avenue, I think you'll have to conclude that by nature it's a public facility. Another comparison was made by comparing Parkview and Point McKenzie. In that particular incident, I can understand why the comparison was made, because a lot of the same folks are traded back and forth there. Point McKenzie has people that are from a more secured location, say Palmer Camp or some other place. And after they work out for a while, they're monitored. Looks like they'll make it on a furlough, then they're furloughed to either Parkview or one of the CRCs, and then they go to work. People that don't make it at a halfway house, if they break their furlough, they usually end up being placed back at Point McKenzie, or even if they were somewhere else, they end up there. They're a little bit closer monitored because they're there 24 hours a day. We also put some misdemeanors over there because if they don't meet the criteria of a halfway house, sometimes we send them there as an option. So they have a different, although some of the people are the same, they do have a different population. But it's also different in the fact that Point McKenzie is a work farm. Just the requirements of having animals, heavy-duty equipment. There's a lot of other huge costs involved, which drives the cost up there as well. That's kind of all I had. Appreciate the time.
No, I appreciate you coming through, Gary. Representative Brown.
Thank you. Could you go over again what is the relationship between the state of Alaska and the municipality of Anchorage with respect to the 6th Avenue facility? Who owns it, who's paying who, how much, and how? I understand there's a large balance that the municipality owes the state. Is that correct?
The city owns the building, and it is slated at some point to be turned over to the museum. That's been in the paper. And I'm, as you said, you've heard probably a lot more than I have. We do a client billing with city prisoners. We do client billing for federal prisoners, for immigrations, U.S. Marshals, federal Bureau of Prisons. And occasionally, we'll do Fort Richardson and Elmendorf if we have some of their folks. We compile all the information as to how long those prisoners were there and send out a bill. We send that bill to our Juneau Central office, and since we don't get the money back into our budget, I don't exactly know where that goes, so I can't answer that type of question.
Margaret, you want to join us?
What percent of your prisoners normally are city prisoners?
What percent?
The city of Anchorage prisoners.
I don't have the figures right on top of my head, but I would guess probably somewhere around 60 or 70.
60 or 70%? And do we pay rent to the city for the use of the facility for the people there that are state prisoners? Or is that credited? I guess another question I have is there a written agreement that governs the
states? There's an old written agreement, Representative Brown, and simply put, the city owns the building. Some time ago, negotiated the price of $1.5 million that they will pay. And they do pay that, and then they write off the cost of the building, which seems to me, not having it right here in front of me, seems to me that it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $350,000, $380,000 that the building was estimated value at, or something in there. So that would be up to about $1.8 million. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but and as you know, program receipts don't go back into that. So Gary takes in the program receipts to the tune of $1.5 million, even if it's $5 million in billings. That's all that they've taken in the last couple of years. It was only $1 million last year.
So how much money do you have on the books outstanding as being owed by the municipality?
I don't know, but I know that the Division of Administrative Services is working on that now.
And is that the city is disputing this existing agreement, or I mean, why are they not paying the amounts?
The city feels, you know, I'm going to meet with some folks tomorrow in the city, but I can tell you that the folks that I don't want to mischaracterize their feelings. They don't want to pay anymore.
I think it's a fair assessment. I've been asking the same questions. Their assessment is that they have an agreement with the state. They built, you know, it's their facility. They give it to the state to available to them in exchange for services the state provides them. Their point is, we're at least you're paying some cost. If you want to get down to brass tacks, we could get to the point that Fairbanks is at, where they repealed all municipal ordinances and they prosecute everyone under state law. Then they could not only do away with some of these incarceration costs, but they could also do away with, I believe, 11 to 13 prosecutors, which they keep on hand. To prosecute these people, and they'd have to all be prosecuted under state law by state prosecutors and drive the state budget up higher. So their feeling is that they are participating at a level that is reasonable given what facilities they are providing. That's a rough summary.
I've heard those arguments.
They don't want to pay anymore.
That's the bottom line, yeah.
Well, are they paying what they have agreed to pay? Can you say they don't want to pay any more than what was agreed to when?
Several years ago. I think the last agreement was signed, may have been updated in 91. It was an agreement in 89, and it was updated later.
I think it draws to a point that I made earlier, and that the commissioner and I have spent a fair amount of time talking about, and that is the fact that we've got to get communities in the state to begin shouldering some of the cost for their desire for crime, getting tough with crime. And that's not just Anchorage. That includes Fairbanks, that includes Barrow, that includes Dillingham, and everywhere else in the state where they put people away.
That's correct. Representative and I have spoken about it before, and we've spoken about people's willingness to put money into enforcement on the local level, but a lack of willingness to put money into the other parts of the criminal justice system on the local level. There's no hesitancy to put money into enforcement, but there seems to be a hesitancy to take care of those that are breaking those laws.
So I think that is a challenge that we're going to have to look at for the next few years here. That's why it's really good to have Representative Davis, who was involved with AML in the past, to help us. No, I think we're going to have to work through AML. Let's try to work cooperatively with them. I mean, I hate to be a big brother, so just impose things on them rather than, as opposed to having them involved in the process, working with the state and with the legislature to try and come up with some reasonable alternatives here.
What's the total number of prisoners in 6th Avenue, average?
average is, at midnight, is about 120. But it come in at 6 o'clock in the morning and be 140. 8 o'clock, it'll be 170. It's really hard to pin down actual, but we usually go by the midnight stats or the 6 o'clock in the morning stats. They're a little bit different.
And what's the billing rate per prisoner per day that you're billing the city and the federal government for?
It's $578 a day and $59 for a halfway house. I'll get you that, Representative Brown. I have it in my briefcase, which I left in the car. I can get you that.
The federal is a little bit higher.
Yeah,
but they have fewer,
for the federal.
Fewer prisoners.
What's the total budget for your facility?
It's under four.
It's about 4 million?
Under four. It's 3.8.
Gary, how many long-term prisoners do you have in your facility?
Our long-term prisoners would be the female felons. Rarely would we have anybody sentenced there, so they could be there pretrial anywhere from 30 minutes to over a year. Some of the felons are there over a year.
So you rarely have someone in your facility for longer than a year?
Right. We had one back in the early 80s who was a special case. He just didn't want to go to court because he had something pending in Texas. He was there 6 years as a pretrial.
But you would be obligated to keep him for as long as they were in the pretrial status, but he probably doesn't run very many male sentence prisoners ever.
No, as soon as
females are sentenced.
As soon as the people are sentenced, we try to get them out as soon as we can because that's the way we make room inside the jail. They stack up real fast. People get sentenced at court 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, so we're scrambling after that to get them designated, time accounting sheets done, and transferred out to generally CRC. But average stay for a male would be 3 to 5 days, females maybe 4 months, just those rough figures.
I just wanted to ask where the responsibility is with these 60-70% of the municipal people charged under municipal law that leave your facility and go to some other facility. Does the state then assume their cost of incarceration? So.
Yes.
There's no municipal responsibility carrying on into the future? Why would there be in this facility if not in the downstream housing of the person after they're sentenced?
Whenever we place, we track the billing on everybody. If a person comes in as a city prisoner and they're there 2 or 3 days to get sentenced, we designate them, put them in a halfway house, we still bill the city while they're in the halfway house at the halfway house rate. So we do recoup.
At the reduced rate.
We do recoup the municipal funds that way.
Okay, is the municipality paying the billings for costs not related to 6th Avenue? I've heard there is a very large discrepancy between what they're being asked to pay and what they're paying. I'm just trying to understand where it is and if that's correct.
Representative Brown, I probably should stop by your office and chat with you about it, get my briefcase from the car and come by and talk to you about it. But because program receipts don't go back to the institution, I think superintendent would be less able to address the issue.
There's a way we can increase the budget. Give them program receipts.
But it's only 1.5 from the municipality of Anchorage.
Which brings up a point, and I've just asked a question, and whether you have an answer or not, are all your program receipts in the front section of the budget? Is that a front section?
Not usually.
Okay.
Usually be back here, just should be showing.
Yeah.
It's not an unappropriated general.
No.
We'd have to appropriate it to them, but they're saying they collect receipts, they're not able to.
It just shows up as a funding source.
You are using it as a funding source, or you're not?
It just shows up there. It's program receipts.
This money from the municipality.
So it's shown in the.
It's shown in there.
In the general fund allocation source.
Okay. It's part of their allocation, part of their appropriation.
Yes.
Our program receipts, correct.
And so is everything anticipated to come in, actually coming in under program receipts?
If we take in more, we have to come back and request more. Remember last year, we had to come in and ask for.
I know, but I understand that, but I'm just asking whether the amount budgeted is actually coming in.
Yes, I think so. I don't know which figure you're looking at at the moment.
Looking at the total program receipts.
There were a couple that did not, some federal funds.
$2.4 million.
But you're looking under.
General fund program receipts.
Pretty much.
Okay, are there any other questions for Gary? Really appreciate you stopping by. I'm looking forward to stopping by in the next couple of weeks to tour your facility and your last ones for me to go through. And I also appreciate the commissioner coming today. I know that she's got a busy schedule and she's had other things that, other places she needs to be. I do believe, has Jeff Wiseman come? Come on in.
No, he's not here.
Okay, Jeff didn't make it. Is there anyone else that would like to testify before the committee? We've got a couple minutes here. We're going to try and break at 12:30, so thank you, Gary, for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, she's right with you.
My name is Gary Damron, and as you can probably assume, I'm a correctional officer with the state of Alaska. My father was a correctional officer before me, and my brother's been a correctional officer, and between the three of us, we have over 30 man years of dedication to this department. And what I see is that the legislature is unhappy with what's happening inside the department, and that you're trying to contract out these jobs of these staff people, the people that work on the line every day, that come in, night out, day out. They're 24-hour facilities. These people have been doing a good job. Alaska has the safest record of any system in the United States, and despite what some of the other people have told you during this committee hearing and during the one before this, Alaska's correctional officers are not the highest paid in the nation. That's simply untrue. I don't care what anybody says, it's not true. California, Connecticut, and several other states all pay higher than the state of Alaska does for correctional officers. The next thing I'd like to do is give a little history lesson. The Walnut Street Jail was opened up in the late 1700s in Philadelphia by the church. It was a private prison, private jail. Well, the citizens of Philadelphia took it back over by 1800. In the late 1880s, Louisiana tried privatizing their prisons. By 1885, they had taken it back over. For every glorious, stellar example that you can show of the success of privatization, I can show you 100 failures. It simply doesn't work. The other thing is your Representative Mulder's little flyer asked about savings. How can we propose savings? The men and women of the Department of Corrections have tried for years. The line staff have come forward every single year that I know. I represent them for the union and on the international union. Every year they've come forward with cost-saving incentives that have been either ignored or told it's impossible to do this. What's so impossible about turning out the lights where people don't work at night? It's a simple thing. Cook Inlet's electrical bill is $15,000 a month. Yet every light in the place is on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In 1990, a prisoner was evac'd from Fairbanks. Had a heart condition, was gonna die. Well, I was sent from Cook Inlet pretrial to the airport for this one prisoner who'd been sent on a medical evacuation flight with two nurses, paramedic, two correctional officers, on a private plane, flown from Fairbanks to Anchorage. I met the plane at the airport, picked the prisoner up, and we went in an ambulance to Providence Hospital. We looked at the notes, and the notes from the people in Fairbanks, the doctor in Fairbanks said, "We think this guy's faking." Pretty simple. We think he's faking. We take him in, take him into the emergency room, they do all their tests, they get him up to the cardiac care unit. Doctor comes in, he says, "We think this guy's faking." Okay, fine, release him, I'll take him back to jail, end of the story. Well, no, we can't do that. Why can't you do that? Well, sir, we have to make sure that he's okay. This prisoner stayed in the hospital for 15 days. And what was at, the doctor ran all the tests, every test you could think of, thallium stress test. We'll do any kind of test we can think of. We better do some more x-rays. We need more blood tests. So finally, on about the 12th day, and I was on overtime the whole time, it was my week off. On about the 12th day, I asked the doctor, I said, "Doctor," I said, "from the night we brought this prisoner here, you told me you thought he was faking." "Well, yeah, he is faking." "Then why did you run all these tests? Why did you keep this prisoner here? Why didn't you let me take him back to jail?" "Because I know the state of Alaska will pay me for all of this stuff, yet it'll pay for prisoners who can't, or for other people who can't pay me." And I said, "Are you serious?" He said, "Yes." And you know, to date, we still use this same cardiologist, this same guy. It doesn't matter what we say. I can think of another prisoner who is going to die in prison. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He is going to die in prison. Yet we've spent $1.5 million on his health care. He's had, to date, 4 ear operations that I know of. He's had 3 angiograms. That's, you want to know why there's a 600% increase? That's why. We've increased our population. We've increased the length of times of their sentences. We've brought almost all of our prisoners back from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And yet our system is still at its capacity. There has been no long-term maintenance, no expansion of our system. So what are we going to do? A crisis has developed. There's no denying that. We have a crisis. We don't have enough beds for the people that we're putting in prison. The choice we have to do is, are we going to put them in with $8 an hour rent-a-cops, or are we going to put them in with highly trained, motivated, dedicated COs? I'm proud that when I go someplace and they ask me where I work, my 5-year-old daughter chimes in. He works at Highland Mountain Correctional Center. She's not at all bashful about telling people where I work. I wasn't at all bashful about telling my dad where he worked. He was a correctional officer just like I am. The message that this committee and the legislature sent in is that we're not doing a good job. We're doing a good job. We're doing the best job in the nation. Put our track record up against anybody. Not, if you want, go against the world. I got a $20 bill in my pocket that says you can't find a better system anywhere in the world than what you have. Do you want to keep it that way? That's up to you. You're the people who make the choices. I can go on to strings about failures in Alaska. We have an 8-year-old Valley girl and her mother are dead. And all the sorry in the world is never going to bring them back, but they are gone because of something that our department did. We released a drunk driver to a halfway house who walked away, got drunk, got in his car. And despite what anybody says, that's a liability, and I can see the lawsuits coming already. That's a liability that this department is going to have to face. because of privatization already. And Mr. Weimer shows you very nice dog and pony shows, real nice movies, but ask him where the prisoners in his movies are. Most of them are back in prison. And I know that Mr. Weimer has lots of lawyers and lots of campaign contributions and lots of other stuff that I can't hold a candle to. All I can do is come to you and tell you the truth. I've been in law enforcement all of my adult life, and I consider corrections law enforcement. There's those that don't, that were guards, were Neanderthals. We did a little informal survey when I was stationed at Cook Inlet pretrial, and over 40% of the correctional officers working the line, not the administrators, but the correctional officers working the line, had at least an associate's degree. 15% had bachelor's, and about 1% had master's degrees. I don't think Mr. Weimer or Corrections Corporation of America, Wackenhut, or any of the other people that are running prisons for profit can say, I have a master's level educated staff member working the line. They just can't do it. You have the most motivated, best trained, most dedicated staff of any system anywhere. Is that what you want? I think so. I think that's what the public demands from you as legislators. They don't want to go back to the days where correctional officers were called guards and they were Neanderthal knuckle draggers. Do you know why people work at private prisons? It's simple. They can't get a job at a publicly funded one because they don't meet the minimum requirements. You, as legislators, have to make the final decision as what you want to do with your system. Because in the end, you have the final say. You want to talk about stellar systems, Representative Mulder? This is a stellar system. No matter what anybody tells you, no matter what Mr. Weimer, Allvest, CCA, Wackenhut, InSearch, any of them want to say, this is a stellar system. This is what the rest of them should be modeled by. Everybody tells us, well, this is not how we do it outside. How many officers did you get killed last year? 10. How many prisoners got killed last year? 36. You know what we say? We've never lost an officer. We've never lost a prisoner in terms of being killed in a facility. Yes, we've had our escapes, and those have been corrected by and large due to whatever reason. We've gone back, we've looked at the problem, and we fixed it. So when you're up there and you're thinking about what it costs, think about the grand scheme of things. Look at the whole picture, not just the limited one, saying we can save 1% right now, which as Mr. Valesco was so kind to report, the only objective study ever done was done by the National Institute of Corrections on two facilities in Tennessee. And what they came back was, there might be a 1% savings. We're not sure, but there might be a 1% savings of this private prison. What they didn't tell you was that the state of Tennessee sent their very finest prisoners to this facility and called them medium custody, just like we did in Arizona. We sent them the cream of the crop, the ones that weren't management problems, the ones that weren't going to sue our ass off every time we turned around. So what do you want? Do you want escapes? Do you want people getting killed? Do you want more escapes? That's what you're going to get when you start privatizing this system. You've got a good system. You've got the best system. The choice is yours. And I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gary, for testifying. I think that the premise of your testimony was based on the fact that this committee is dissatisfied with the service being provided. I think that's a faulty assumption. That's never been our position, that we're dissatisfied with the service. The question that we have to face, and that I think large part is a testimony to our committee in terms of what we've attempted to do, is depoliticize corrections in the last year. We're trying to just look at objectively and not try and endanger or jeopardize you folks in terms of the political whims of the day, as much as just be realistic about, but you know, we're not trying to base our decisions on personalities. We're trying to base it purely on dollars, upon economics, not with the level of service. I mean, nobody's saying you're not doing a good job. I don't hear anybody saying that. The decisions, moreover, are being based on economics and what we can afford and how we make the system efficient, more efficient, and operate better. So I appreciate you coming today. And
well, I would ask this committee then, and we've just recently formed a labor management committee with the department. I would ask any of these members, I'm a member of that committee, I would ask any of you to come and sit with us and listen to how our side says we can save money. We can do it. And we can still have the very best system. But to go out and privatize it, I think, is wrong. It jeopardizes public safety.
Well, you know, I think it is an option out there. And that is something that, if that is distressing to public employees, I'm sorry, but that's the reality. There are options out there. And I think it would be negligent of me as a committee chairman or the whole committee not to look at options, not to look at the full range. Certainly today's focus was trying, you know, and I hoped that more people would come forward and say, listen, here are concrete ways that we can create efficiencies or savings within our correctional system. Unfortunately, I didn't hear a whole lot of new ideas today. Maybe your labor management committee will come up with some concrete proposals, and I hope they do submit some of them to our committee for consideration, because, you know, I can't emphasize enough, I'm serious about the business we're undertaking. We are going to create efficiencies within the system. We are going to learn to live with fewer dollars. This is not a legislature that I see is going to increase our revenues. Consequently, we're going to have to live with fewer dollars. And I want to do that in the most logical, most sensible way possible, trying to do it with inclusion as opposed to exclusion. Take the personalities out of the conflict, make it one of logic, common sense, and hopefully one of agreement.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for coming today. I want to thank everybody for coming and testifying to the committee. Feel free, if in subsequent days there is additional testimony or things that you felt could be submitted to the committee for consideration, feel free to submit them. I'll make certain to get them to Denny DeWitt in my office. Then it will certainly circulate them to the rest of the committee members for inclusion as well. Appreciate the commissioner coming and participating today. I know it's been a busy, hectic week for her, and I really appreciate her willingness to put up with us as well. So with that, I will adjourn this meeting of the Corrections Budget Subcommittee.